Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And it is the ATS Mix program. That means I must be Johnny Anonymous.
I'm his partner, Dave Rabbit. And John, I got to tell you how proud everybody here at AboveTopSecret.com is. And on the things that you've accomplished with all the editing that you've done, man, I am just so tickled. I'm so proud of you, John.
Yeah, and probably thankful that you've not had to watch over 65-plus hours worth of video with still 55-plus hours left to do.
Well, if it's any consolation, John, it's got 215...
Constellation?
Well, it can be consolation if you want to. 215 flags, 168 stars, and 66 digs on the Robbie Williams UFO interview at Gilliland Ranch. That thread that shows all the different things, including the audio interview with Robbie Williams and the videos that you so far have put up, and they have more that they are going to be able to look forward to. Am I correct on that?
You are correct, sir.
Very good. And of course, you're busting your chops, you're busting your keister, you're down in the dungeon, the Springinator is not letting you come up for air.
Is that the video dungeon?
I love the video dungeon. And, you know, they, it really upsets me, John, that we don't get to talk that much anymore. I mean, we talked a lot, 1 o'clock Dallas time this morning, simply because I try to give you a little encouragement and kind of, you know, play that cheerleader game. You know, rah, rah, John, come on now. You can go through the next 54 hours and, you know.
So that's what that was.
I couldn't do it, John. I got to give you standing no. I couldn't do it. You know, that my eyes would already have fallen out of the sockets by now.
Well, even though you were not able to join us on our adventure there in the preliminary investigation at the James Gilliland Ranch, I am looking forward to the end of this month. Tell everybody what's happening at the end of this month.
Well, thanks, John. Thanks for that lead-in. I love those. We're going to be at the Bay Area 10th Annual UFO Expo in Santa Clara, California on the 27th and 28th of this month, September 2008. And the Springinator is going to be there with us, and we're going to have like an ATS Mix area booth that we're going to be there, and we're going to be doing interviews and talking and having a lot of fun, and hope to see everybody there. And if you bring Johnny a box of tea, what kind of tea do you like, John?
I prefer chai, not Thai. That would be like the other thing.
Tai Chi, I thought that's a karate.
Yes, but chai tea. Sorry, I got chai dyslexic tea. There for a second.
Okay, chai tea. You bring me a can of bush beans. I don't want to hear this nonsense about bring Dave any can of beans you want. No, they got to be bush beans. I'm looking to get them to be a sponsor for us. They got to be bush beans. You bring bush beans, and Johnny and I'll autograph the can and give it back to you and give you 10,000 ATS points for the first 10 that do it. And if you bring the Springinator, any kind of maker's mark. It can be a pint, it can be a quart, it can be a gallon, it can be whatever size you want to afford. But if you bring the maker's mark to the Springinator, you're going to be in good shape. And
very good shape.
We are going to have a lot of fun at the 10th annual show.
Absolutely. Getting back to this episode of the ATS Mix, you know, I tried to keep leaving the Gilliland Ranch every day, and every day I kept being told, oh, you should stick around. There's so-and-so showing up, and he's coming here to talk to you. Well, one of these fine gentlemen that wanted to come by and speak with me was the former advisor to the Pope, and he was on the International Theological Commission, and at the time that he was on that commission for 7 or 8 years with that pope, which was Pope John Paul. Guess who else was on that commission with him?
Let me think. Johnny Carson.
Correct. No, it was our current pope, and our current pope would be?
Pope Benedict. And you know how I know that, John?
I give up.
Because, you know, the Pope and I, you know, have really, we've been emailing each other. He's become one of my new email buds, you know.
That's yeah, great, yeah. Dave.
He's asking my advice on several different issues, John.
My condolences.
Yeah, we're going to take the Catholic Church. We're going to take the Catholic Church in a whole different direction.
Anyway.
I mean, tithing is going to take on a new meaning with the Rabbinator.
Absolutely. In this episode, we're going to find out what aliens, Jesus, and orbs all have in common with one another.
Really?
Yeah.
Do they do like, do they have, is it include the rosary or, you know,
no, there's no mention of the rosary.
How about D batteries?
No, but we do talk about the secret archives of the Vatican.
Really?
And our guest that we're going to be interviewing, or that I interviewed up there at the Gilliland Ranch, is Dr. Michal Ledwith.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I know, John, because I know how methodical you are in interviews.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear this, so why don't you shut up, John, and let's listen to you and your guest.
Well, okay then. Here he is, my interview with Dr. Michal Ledwith.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Be good, Dave.
Well, that was being good.
A-T-S Mix. Featured interview.
And since I generally have a bio in front of me and know exactly what I'm going to ask, and I have to caution you listeners now, I am flying blind. And so this is going to be just as unique for me as it will be for you. And I would like to just have our guest perhaps tell us a little bit about himself. He is Dr. Michal Ledwith. Is that correct? I hope I said that.
That's correct.
All right, sir.
I always say to people, Johnny, if you remember, I made all my money in U-Haul, then you can pronounce Michal. It's the Irish for Michael.
I like it. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You have had a very interesting and colorful history.
Yes.
So tell us perhaps in stages how you got to where you presently are now.
Okay. Well, I'm living in Washington State now, near Olympia, the capital. But I was ordained a Catholic priest in 1967, before a lot of your listeners were born. And I became a professor of theology. I taught theology for many years. I eventually became vice president of the university, and I served a 10-year term as president of the university, which ended in 1994, at which stage I moved to the United States. And I also served as a member of a small group of theologians who were charged with advising the Holy See, that's the Vatican, or the Pope, on theological matters, called the International Theological Commission. I served three terms on that from 1980 to 1997. There were 3 5-year terms, but they were extended once or twice through some small things that happened, like, for instance, when unfortunately Pope John Paul II was shot that time and that attempted assassination, so we were extended rather than a new commission appointed. So I ended up 17 years, and for 16 of those 17 years, the chairman of our small group was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who's the present Pope, Pope Benedict XVI. So that's more or less where I am. I moved here and I've been a member of the Ramtha School of Ancient Wisdom for a long time, and that's what I'm working on now. I've produced a series of DVDs on matters that I think are of very central importance. I used often say that, you know, everyone has to face three great questions. Who are we? Am I just this arms and legs and a physical body, or is there something more or less to me? Where did we come from? You know, did I just pop in here unannounced, whatever, 10, 20, 40, 50, 100 years ago, or is there more to me than that? What should I do while I'm here? Is it just a matter of obeying, you know, a certain number of rules, say, 720 if I'm Muslim, or 538 if I'm Jewish, or 10 if I'm Christian? Or is there more to it than that? And then the ultimate question, of course, if you want to add a fourth, what can I expect if things go wrong and I have to hand over and check back in my physical body? So those are the four great questions.
Sure.
And that's what I came here to devote the rest of my time to doing, is to answering those for myself at least. And I've produced in that process a number of DVDs, 3 DVDs so far. One is about the notions of God that have kept so many of us imprisoned and have caused so many people to become atheists and agnostics. And it's no wonder, I think, that so many have, when you see the distorted images of God, the all too human versions of God that most people cherish. and how these block our spiritual empowerment and evolution, which, you know, Jesus referred to when he said, if you follow my teachings, you will do all the wonders, the miracles, that is, that I did or do, and greater indeed than these will you do, in the Gospel of John.
Right.
Now, where's that happening today? Not very significantly anywhere. So obviously something has gone wrong.
Right.
So I set out, you know, with my background as a professor of theology for so many years, to try to find out what had gone wrong and how we can fix it to our betterment. So I produced that first DVD originally. Then I did another one on Jesus himself, because I think most of the journey that we're here to do is to do with programming the subconscious or superconscious mind, because that's how, when I was in What the Bleep Do We Know, that little movie that a lot of your listeners may have heard or seen, what we were trying to convey in that little movie was how we actually program the quantum field of reality, and that is what generates the kind of life I experience, whether it's misery or lack or triumph or joy or whatever. We know that whether we realize it or not, we are actually generating this kind of experience. Now, the key to doing that properly is a thing which What the Bleep didn't get into, because it couldn't within the limits that we had. So the key to it is programming the superconscious, because it's not the conscious mind that programs the quantum field. And that's what everyone assumes. And that's why all our self-improvement programs fail, ranging from New Year resolutions to this, that, or the other, or even to things like The Secret and so forth,
right,
just published by the same publisher as my own publisher. You know, we think it's the conscious mind, and it's not. And this, I was in England 2 weeks ago speaking at a conference in Glastonbury, where we had a huge attendance from all over the world, and that was my topic. How do we program the subconscious mind or superconscious so that we are able to generate what we want? Because if you rely on the conscious mind to do that, I'm sorry to say, it won't work. And that's why so many people, I think, have, you know, been disappointed, you know, that they hear this wonderful program, the law of attraction and all this stuff, and they think it's a matter of sitting down and, you know, waiting for it all to land in your lap. And it's not at all about that. So let's take a little example. The conscious mind, we're told now by neuroscience in the last decade, is able to process about 2,000 bytes of information per second, which in, say, in computer terms, that's colossal. But by contrast with that, they reckon that the superconscious mind is able to process 400 billion pieces of information per second. Now, which would you rather have access to? And that, unfortunately, the superconscious mind, you know, is a very, very strange commodity. Because, first of all, it has no judgment on anything. And number two, what comes to us from the outside, the external, the real world, you and I might say,
right,
it's unable to distinguish between that and between what we vividly imagine as real. And that's the key. And, you know, when Jesus said, when you pray for something, believe it's already yours and it shall be so, no one could have said that better. Because that is the key to manifestation. If you believe it is already so, then you're going to get that through to the superconscious mind, which in turn will get it through to the quantum field, which is the sixth plane of reality. And from there, cascading down the waterfall of the dimensions, your reality will arrive with some delay, however long or short, depending on your degree of focus.
Right.
But that is how reality is created. So I, of course, was of the view, as a result of many years of research, that this is actually what Jesus came to teach us. And many things that fascinated me turned up in the process. For instance, you know, when I was looking at the New Testament stories of the life of Jesus in the Gospels, I calculated one day that, you know, there's an awful lot of gaps here of people. You know, we hear about him for a brief period of a couple of days when he's born in Bethlehem. And then we hear he went to Egypt with his family to escape the persecution of King Herod. And we don't know how long he spent there. Some say 2 years, some say more, some say less. But anyway, give it 2 years. So now we've heard about roughly 2 years of his life, no details. And then there's nothing at all until we hear about him for 3 days, a huge span of time, when he's 12. In the temple, when he's there, presumably for his bar mitzvah. And after those 3 days, we now have 2 years and 3 days covered out of 12 years. But after that, he vanishes for 18 years, which right. is longer than the rest of his entire life.
Right, right.
And, you know, we're told in the blissful phrase in St. Luke's Gospel, he went down to Nazareth and was subject to them, and advanced in wisdom, age, and grace before God and men, and doesn't appear again till he's 30 years old. And lo and behold, he appears out of this 18-year apprenticeship, which the tradition wants us to assume, was spent working in the carpenter shop with Joseph, making tables and chairs and bird feeders, I presume. And after that apprenticeship, he's able to come out, heal the sick, walk on water, raise the dead, and manifest food out of thin air. Now, if that's actually what he was doing, I often thought we'd be much better employed giving up what we're at and taking a course in woodwork straight away, because it obviously has wonderful results.
Yes.
But of course, as you rightly suspect, that is not what I believe he was doing. So I set out to try to find out, in that 18 missing years particularly, and in the missing years previously to it, you know, more than 85% of the life of Jesus is missing totally from the New Testament.
Right.
And I began to think there was more to the life of Jesus than we were getting. And so, to make a long story very short, what I did discover were a number of things. Number one, with regard to the age of 12 to 30, I discovered that there was in existence a series of scrolls that were discovered by a Russian aristocrat, Nicholas Notovich, in the late 1880s. In the monastery of Hemis in Tibet, now in Kashmir, and that those told a very different account of the life of Jesus from the age of 14 onwards. And also I realized from my own researches as a theologian that the basic tenets, say, of the Christian Church, which hinge around sacraments, these sacred ceremonies, which, you have different numbers of sacraments in different branches of Christianity. Say in the Catholic branches, you have 7, which is a sacred number, as you know. What I began to realize is, from my studies in Egyptology and so forth, is that along the River Nile in Egypt, there are 7 temples, or there were 7, the remains are still there, 7 temples that corresponded to what you and I would call today the 7 chakras in the New Age terminology, or the 7 seals, as my own teacher, Ramtha, would call them. And that, unlike what you and I would try to do today, which is to grapple with all these issues towards enlightenment, that there was a system in place in ancient Egypt whereby you went to the first temple, which was at Aswan, near where the dam is now, and you dealt with the issues of the first seal. Then when you graduated from that, you went into another course of teaching and you moved to the second temple, which is at Kom Ombo, further up the Nile. And the issues of the second seal, of course, are victimization, pain and suffering, which I'm pausing on here a little, because this is the root and the heart of the problems with Christianity today. That precise seal, that precise chakra, pain, suffering, guilt, all that stuff. And, of course, this endless recycling of it that drive the engines of religion. We're raised to the heights of forgiveness, and if before we get too cocky, we're plunged back again into the depths of guilt and despair, and we have to be redeemed again. And it's like a Tesla's machine, you know,
right.
Coils.
Sure.
It's generating something, but is it generating something that evolves you and I, or is it just keeping us endlessly spinning our tires in the ice and snow? I'm afraid that's all it's doing. So in the second temple at Kom Ombo in ancient Egypt, you were obviously taught and instructed and trained, and then you came to your test, And this building is still there. And you went in one door, and you came out at the end of the test through another door beside it. A lot more went in one door than came out the other. Because the test was this. You were instructed in all the pitfalls of pain and suffering and feeling I'm a victim and life is not fair and it's, you know, they're out to get me and I'm helpless, I'm just a pawn in a pinball machine buffeted around by more powerful people and forces and organizations, all that stuff, which is a huge block for us as a race today. So anyway, you were told all about that and how to deal with it, and then came your test to see how well you'd absorb the lesson. So you were brought blindfolded in through the door on the left, and you were told to take off your blindfold. And when you did, you were standing on the edge of a pool of water, a deep pool. And you were told to jump in. Now, there was a catch, because there were crocodiles in the pool. Now, if you had mastered the issues of pain and suffering, victimization, and oh, poor me, well, what you would do, you would jump in. But most people hadn't. You know, they thought they had, but most people hadn't. So you couldn't fail this test and continue. You had no second chance. So you either went through this test or you left the sequence of temples that brought you to enlightenment. So if you were not well prepared, what would you do? What any, I suppose, average person would do. You jumped into the pool and you tried to avoid the crocodiles. You splashed around a bit. And splashing is not a career move in a crocodile pool.
Crap, yeah.
So generally the test was over quickly. But if you did, you know, if you had mastered the issues of pain and suffering, you dove straight down into the pool. And as you can still, it's dry today, but if you ever visit there, you can see that at the bottom of the pool there was a tunnel. It's about 12 feet long. And now, of course, if you have claustrophobia or that, you're not going to swim in under 10 feet of water into a dark tunnel, not knowing if there's an exit, because of claustrophobia.
Sure.
But one of the greatest treatments for claustrophobia is a crocodile snapping at your heels. So you go through this tunnel underwater and come out into another pool, separated from the previous one by a wall, and there are no crocodiles. You've passed the test.
Oh.
And you go out the other door. So the point I'm making is that these seven temples up the Nile had initiations attached to them, which if you look at the Christian system of the seven sacraments is remarkably similar. So here we look at Jesus, the hidden years of Jesus in this second DVD that I made. His hidden years in Egypt and his hidden years in India and Tibet. Now, as I mentioned earlier, for the Tibetan period, we have the scrolls of Notovitch that tell about his years there. And apparently, those scrolls exist in many monasteries in India and Tibet to this day.
Really?
But these are the only ones that have actually come to light. But Bharati Krishnatirtha, who was the head of the great monastery at Puri, came here to the Yogananda school to visit in the early 50s, and he testified at that time that there were many monasteries that had similar scrolls about the life of Jesus in India and Tibet. So that's one thing, and we know what he did. He went there, he spent 6 years in the great cities. He arrived in India at the age of 14. He spent 6 years in the great cities looking for a master to teach him, because they'd heard all these stories of the fabulous fabled beings who could levitate, bilocate, manifest out of thin air, etc., heal the sick at a touch. And all he found were pompous gurus who wanted to be waited on and worshipped and reaffirmed in their egos. So after the 6 years, he went up into the hills, up into the mountains, up near Valipastu, where Buddha was born, and up on the western side of Mount Everest and into Nepal. And there he did find the great masters, and there he did learn all of these things that were potentials in the human person. Nothing to do with brands of religion or anything else. This is not a religious matter. All of these wonders have nothing to do with religion. Religion has capitalized on them.
Right.
But they're not to do with religion. They are native endowments of you and I because of the God within us all that comes down through these seven planes of existence above us. So for the years of Jesus, that we heard little about in Egypt and or in India and Tibet. We have those scrolls. Now, in Egypt, we don't, unfortunately, have a similar set of scrolls. But when I looked at the seven temples of initiation at the mystery schools in Egypt, and I saw how similar some of them were to the sacraments of the Christian Church, it is obvious to me that Jesus was in Egypt and learned from those sources. Just as if Nicholas Notovitch's scrolls had never been found in the 1880s, I would have known that Jesus was in India and Tibet. Why? Because when I look at the Gospels of the New Testament and I look at what he did as recounted in the Gospels, I can trace about 112 or 13 major parallels between his teachings and that of the Buddha Gautama.
Really?
Who, of course, was 500 years earlier.
Sure.
All of the major parables of Jesus are also found in the Buddha's teaching. Now, does that mean that Jesus was a plagiarist? On the contrary. I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. No more than the Buddha was a plagiarist. They were both channels of a very ancient wisdom that's as old as the foundations of the earth.
Right.
So, as I said, even if there were no scrolls found by Nicholas Notovitch in Hemus, I would have known that Jesus was in India because his whole teaching is so similar to the Buddha's. So for that reason, I also know that he was in Egypt, because the system of sacraments that the Christian Church inherited from Jesus are basically founded on the initiation rites of the seven temples up the Nile. So this was a very interesting picture of Jesus for me when I discovered it. And I put it all down. I tried to distill it all down into, I think, something under 4 hours, which is a double DVD set called How Jesus Became a Christ.
I would assume, sir, that you're not very popular.
There are certain quarters. There are certain quarters in which I used to be more popular.
Yes.
Let us put it that in a genteel way like that. No. Oh, no, there are people who would and have tried to, you know, excoriate me off the face of the earth.
No.
Oh, yes. But that's another story.
When you were involved with the Vatican, and the name of...
We were advisor with the group, the small group of theologians. They're from all over the world.
Sure.
We were called the International Theological Commission.
Commission, all right.
Yeah, it's still there. It's functioning quite well.
I would assume that would have given you, like, what we would know in what we call the three-letter acronym agencies here in the United States, like the CIA and DOJ. You have to have a certain amount of clearance to be able to have access to information. Would you, sir, have had that same type of access? I mean, could you have seen perhaps like what they have hidden down below the Vatican?
Well, I don't believe that there's anything very spectacularly hidden in the Vatican. I built in the university I was president of, one of our projects in which I was in charge of at the time was building a new university library. So I know something about libraries.
Right.
And, you know, there's all this mystique about the secret archive of the Vatican.
Right.
And there is also a belief that somehow, since the time of St. Peter, that things have been more or less consistent through all the ages down to the present, and that there's a wonderful system of archives and records there since that time. They forget the sacking of Rome by the Goths and the Visigoths and the Vandals and the Huns and the Normans, say, in the 12th century, and then Napoleon, who took all of the archives of the Vatican to Paris.
Really?
Not all of it came back. And what of it did come back, you know, being carted on the backs of mules and donkeys for 1,500 miles, it wasn't in great condition. But if you were to go into the secret archive of the Vatican today, it's as a great cardinal once said, a prospect to dizzy and appall, because there's a huge amount of material there, and it's not classified. So unless you know what you're looking for and you knew where to look,
right,
you know, you're just amazed. Someone asked me there one time, what in your opinion would it cost and how long would it take to classify the secret archives of the Vatican? Now, of course, you have to remember that the language of those archives, that are almost all handwritten, are ancient Greek and Latin. Latin is still the Church's official language, classical Latin. And its successor, you know, the Church Latin. Then you have medieval German, French, Spanish, you know, and so on. So, the first thing you would have to have, obviously, if you're going to work on these archives, is a few people who would know those languages.
Sure.
And those are few and far between.
Right.
So let's say we were lucky and we got five qualified people who would work full-time and be amply rewarded for it, and they would set to work classifying the secret archive of the Vatican. And I said to this person, I said, the money is the least of the... It costs a lot of money, but we could get the money if needs be, I'm sure. But I said, the bigger problem is much greater than that. And he said, what was that? I said, because I assume that if we could get these five people and that everything was working right, it would take them between 100 to 125 years to process the material.
Oh, my.
So if you're asking me, you know, what would it take to categorize the secret archive of the Vatican, I would say that's how long it would take with five people who are immensely qualified. So the chance, you know, I think, and what I'm coming around to by a very long route, and I apologize for dragging this out, is that I think undoubtedly there are things in that archive that are immensely important. Undoubtedly there are things that were put away there to be hidden. And I have only to think of a text like the Gospel of Thomas that was found in India, in Egypt, in 1946. You know, maybe there is a copy of that text there. Undoubtedly, there's a text like one of the 50 Bibles that the Emperor Constantine commissioned the early 4th century,
sure,
which is, I think, the text of the New Testament called the Codex Vaticanus. You know, there are things like that, very precious things like that. But to think that there is someone sitting there, you know, with a loaded shotgun, trying to keep people from some magic document, this belongs to the world of fairy tale. There isn't such a thing, and there's no one there doing that. They have better things to do. But it is a pity that vast resource, you know, isn't in better order, because the disorder has been brought by the accidents of history and pillaging, looting, and wars, and so forth.
Right.
But when we reached the bottom line of all of those great collections, like at the University of Alexandria, which was burned by a Christian mob, by the way, and say the archives of the Vatican, the archives of the British Museum, the archives of the Library of Congress here in this country, you know, no matter what information you have, a time comes when you've got to put it to use. And if you don't put the information to use, what the heck, you know, what
good
is the
it?
Point of it?
Exactly.
In other words, say, take the average person, you know, they're trying to put their children through school, keep themselves in good health, eat well, pay their mortgage, you know, bring the children to daycare, walk the dog. You know, what, am I just here for a relatively brief period? You know, I used to often wonder when I was a professor, and I was privileged, especially in that commission I mentioned, to work with people from all over the world who were the absolute tops in their field, renowned names. And, you know, the tragedy that often struck me, people like Karl Rahner, who was probably one of the greatest theologians in the world, or Hans-Urs von Balthasar, who was undoubtedly the greatest living theologian, whom I knew very well. But when I knew him, he was already in his mid-70s, and, you know, by the time I ceased knowing him, he was well on into his 80s. And here you have this man of, you know, of immense erudition, immense knowledge, and magnificent human being. And you know that within 5 to 10 years, that's all going to be gone.
Right.
And it occurred to me, you know, that this is not really the way things were meant to be. And when I looked at some of the major sources of the Jewish and Christian tradition, say like the book of Genesis, and I mentioned to you earlier this morning at breakfast about how the divisions of the Old and New Testament were not in the text originally. They were put in by a French printer on the way to work in the morning in his carriage. And I said to you earlier this morning, they bear all the signs of it. But if you look at, say, the creation narratives in Genesis, chapters 2 and 3, as he divided them, you'll see a blissful state pictured there in chapter 2. We call it the paradise state.
Mm-hmm.
In the first 7 verses of chapter 3, you see the fallen state. You know, this as a... I wrote an article for the Bleeping Herald, which is a magazine that came from What the Bleep. I write an article every month, but I wrote one last week on the troubled subject of aliens, because it was prompted by a statement that the new director of the Vatican Observatory made recently, when he said it was okay to believe in aliens, it didn't threaten belief in God. But I said, you know, at the end of my article, the Vatican astronomer, you know, has much more to worry about than aliens threatening belief in God, because every other major Christian doctrine will be challenged to its core because of the way the Church has turned the message of Jesus into an affair of sin and redemption and all that, and suffering and guilt and reparation. That is almost impossible to emerge from. However, back to my point, the book of Genesis has this marvelous picture of a paradise state in chapter 2, then we have a fallen state in the first 7 verses of chapter 3. And the fallen state is the one that you and I are very familiar with. You know, you're sick, disappointed, you're tired, you're hungry, you're aging, you die, etc. And what you will notice if you look at the text with an open mind is that there's a list of everything that we know every day. For instance, in chapter 2, in the paradise state, they're talking about God and his relationship with the first two people, the man and the woman, as the Hebrew puts it. We call it Adam and Eve, but they weren't personal names. So the man and the woman are walking in peace with God. They're walking together in the cool of the evening. The relation between man and woman is also perfect. The relation between God and the two people is perfect. They are two in one flesh, which meant absolute equality, which is an amazing insight for a document of the 8th century before Christ. You have work, which is a blissful state, you know, very easy, looking after a garden. You have life, which is our basic desire to want to live, and they're given everlasting life. So what you have in that list of the paradise state is all the major items of concern to you and me, and they're all ideal and perfect. And now when you come to the fallen state, you go through the same list, God, the couple, the work, etc. And now everything is haywire. There is a huge question mark over everything. When God comes along, instead of the blissful state, they're running and hiding, they're ashamed. The work is in the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. You know, they die, they're mortal, and so on. So you have the absolute opposite of everything that was meant to be. And this is the same feeling that hit me when I talked about those great theologians that I knew and their knowledge. You know, it's all going to vanish when they breathe their last breath. This is not how the world was meant to be. But in Genesis, you have in the second part of chapter 3, as the French printer divided it, the paradise state again. And Pope Gregory the Great, 1500 years ago, put this well. He said, the narratives in Genesis are actually a prophecy, something for the future, set in the past. It's not where we fell from down to this miserable state. It's actually where we're supposed to be heading. And that is the destiny that Jesus came to reveal to us, so that we could walk with God, that we could have perfect unity and equality between man and woman, that our work would be a blissful engagement, and that we would never die. So death was never meant to be part of the original condition. And, you know, it would make much more sense if we didn't die after a relatively short time. And now, of course, science is telling us that we do have an immortal gene in us, and that the way to get that active is to program the superconscious, as I was talking about at Glastonbury recently. So that is what I realized that Jesus actually did come to teach us, was to how to awaken those elements of us that are asleep. Because I gave an image in my DVD, which I brought out in February, on orbs. My book on orbs with Dr. Klaus Heinemann was published by Simon & Schuster and Beyond Words last November 2007. Then I brought out my own DVD, which was meant to be a sort of companion to that and tease out some of the implications of it. I postulated in the book that orbs are not seen by reflected light. Say if I take up a camera here and take a picture of you, the flash goes off, the light bounces off you, and it's reflected back through the lens and registered on the plate, the LCD plate. What happens in the case of an orb, say there's an orb beside you, the flash goes out, it hits the orb, the photons of light hit the orb. The light is not reflected back from the orb to the camera. That is not how orbs are photographed. My hypothesis, at least, is that what happens is this. The light photons from the camera here to the orb here, the light photons hit the orb. They turn into electrons once they hit a solid object, as you know. They spin the electrons already in the orb up to a higher shelf, as they say in physics. So the orb is, it's almost like a balloon when you blow it up. You know, it swells with the extra electrons. And then, of course, when the stimulus of the flash stops, which it does after, say, a thousandth of a second, the orb shrinks back to close to its original size again. Slightly larger, but close to its original size. Now, there's no room for the surplus electrons anymore, so the orb spits those out, and then they become light photons again, and that's the light that comes back to the camera. That's a process known in physics as fluorescence, and that was my hypothesis in the Simon Schuster Beyond Words book,
right,
that that's how orbs are actually captured. Now, why is that important? It's very important. Because, as you know, orbs have different colors. There's the dark red, there's the light color, there's the blue color, there's gold color, there's green, etc. And we know from physics that the frequencies of those light forms betray the origins of which they come. So a great tool in physics is fluorescence that scientists use to examine what a subject is made out of. Say a distant star, or some object in the laboratory, if I can get it to fluoresce, the fluoresced light will tell me what the stuff is made of. So to make a long story short again, if I have a red orb that's emanating light in the infrared frequency, then I know that that belongs to the next dimension of existence above the physical, where we are here in the Hertzian, the radio wave dimension. Above us, our next door neighbor is the infrared frequency, and red orbs are living in that dimension, and white orbs are living in the next dimension above that, which is visible light. Above that we have the ultraviolet realm, and that's where the blue orbs are found, because that's the frequency of ultraviolet light. Above that we have the gold frequency, which is the X-ray band, and above that the gamma frequency, which is rose color. So this reveals to me that reality is a tiered entity, just like my old teacher Ramtha, of course, inspired me to see. You know, I often refer to an atheist or an agnostic as a person with no invisible means of support. That's a joke, obviously. But if we were to imagine, if reality coming from what Erwin Laszlo called the zero point, the origin of creation, which is a term I think that scientists are more happy with when they refer to God, that's fine. But if we regard reality as coming from the zero point, whether down or out from a concentric system of circles into these other dimensions, then we cannot imagine that you and I are down here on the Hertzian plane with nothing in between and the other six dimensions connecting us with the source. Because if we were, we would be people with no invisible means of support. So what the orbs taught me, because of the fluorescence factor, is that you and I, and every person who has ever lived or will live on this physical plane, is also living on the planes above it. So, do I have a body in the infrared realm? Absolutely. Why? Because if I didn't, I wouldn't have one here in the physical. It couldn't exist. Things hang, as I often say, like garments in a closet, you know. The bottom of a garment in a closet can't hang in midair. It has to be connected through the other parts of the garment to the rail on which the hanger rests. And it's like that in the universe. So we have these six realms of existence living inside of us right now, in these other dimensions of existence. And the secret to whatever you want to call it, enlightenment or empowerment or what Jesus said, you will do all the wonders that I did are greater. The secret to doing that is to waken up those other dimensions of ourselves. As an image I use in the DVD, Orbs Clues to a More Exciting Universe, is like an iceberg. You know, an iceberg has, what is it, 1/7 or 1/8 above the surface, and right, the vast bulk of it is hidden underneath. If you turn that upside down, that's what we are like. You know, the tiny, the least significant part of us is the visible part here, the physical. But the really crucial and major parts of what you and I are hidden in frequency this time, not in water. And if we think, in answer to those four great questions I posed at the beginning, that all I am is these two arms and two legs walking right. around, then obviously, you know, you have got it wrong. There are these other aspects to me. And now, if we think about, go back to physics, and, you know, that diagram that's in every high school physics textbook, ranging from the Hertzian, the radio wave, the microwave, into infrared, into visible light, into ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma, etc. All of those dimensions above this, above or outside of whatever way you wish to look at it, I'm inclined not to talk about above and below because of the hamburger universe effect. But all of those dimensions are slightly ahead of us in time. Like infrared is not just a different dimension, it's also ahead of us in time.
Hmm.
So if I can access the infrared dimension, I'm going to know what's coming down the pipeline towards me. If I can access the light realm, which is two above where I am, I will know more into the future. And progressively, as I go, the farther we go into the future, the farther we go up in frequency, the more we are projecting ourselves ahead into the future. So, back to what the bleep, when we did it, we were trying to convey the truth, which physics, of course, has known for 100 years now, that if you can observe the quantum field, which is the sixth of those planes that I mentioned, that's where the first particles come into existence. And if I observe those particles with the part of me that corresponds to the sixth plane, then that reality will take shape. Now, it's in the future, as I said, so it's going to take time to come down the cascade of the intervening six planes till it reaches the physical here with me. That's when most people give up. They say, it's not working. You know, I'm so special that I'm the only person in the universe for which this won't work. This works for everyone. No one is so special that this won't work for. So that's what I realized, this is what Jesus really came to teach. And that he learned all of this. You know, obviously it wasn't the same terminology as we use today. Instead of talking about quantum particles, he used homely terms like the mustard seed or the leaven in the loaf that permeates the whole
land. Something they could relate to.
So they could relate to it. I realized that this is what he was really coming to teach. And you know what? That turning him into the goat and the lamb of Yom Kippur was not what it was about at all. I think that's what happened with the message of Jesus when his disciples were obviously baffled with this magnificent being whom they had known for 2 years and 9 months, who could walk on water, heal the sick, raise the dead, and you know, all of his teachings were about that, and they couldn't get it. They couldn't get it. I referred to you at breakfast this morning about the Gospel of St. Mark, whose main message, if you understand it objectively, is how Jesus' attempts to get the truth across were constantly frustrated. He narrowed his scope from trying to teach everyone to trying to teach his native people of Galilee. When that didn't work, he tried to narrow it down to his own disciples, and that didn't work. They were still asking at the very end of it, who's going to sit at your right hand and your left, judging the 12 tribes of Israel? He said, oh, they. So anyway, this is what Jesus was really about, and this is what he learned, and why he came. Why did he come? Did he come here to suffer and die for our sins? Of course not. He came to do something much more wonderful than that. He came to teach us that we were on the bottom rung of the seventh level dimension, that we came here to make known the unknown of the creation from God. That is the only commandment we had. We have to own it. In other words, I don't want to be caught up in anger and greed and jealousy, which are all limitations. They're all insecurities. And you've never mastered this dimension down here until you've gone over that stuff. So what he came here to teach us was to learn how to own these things. I mean, when Jesus said, forgive one another, you know, do good to those who hate you, don't revile those who persecute you, this wasn't just so we would be nice people. It was enlightened self-interest, because in the quantum field, this is how it works. Believe it's already yours, he said, and it will be so. I don't know how you were taught to pray, but I was taught to pray, you know, if you want something, say if you want $1,000 or something, you say, oh, you know, first of all, you try to cajole God into a sort of receptive mood. And you say, oh, you know, great and wonderful God, and dum-dum-dum, you know, and I'm just a wretched, humble, miserable sinner. Please have mercy on me. I'm in such a desperate state. Could you please give me, you know, because I've flattered you and I've told you how miserable and worthless I am. Could you please get me $1,000? Now, in the quantum field, of course, what's going to happen? What state have I put myself into? I've said I'm a worm and no man or no woman.
You've thrown a real negative connotation on yourself.
You've put a whole negative projection onto the quantum field. So what is your prayer answered? Yes, prayer is, as I've often said, answered 101% of the time. The trouble is we don't advert to what we're actually praying for. Because praying is whatever I accept here in my focus. So if I am truly convinced that I am a worm and no man, that I'm a miserable, lacking person, what will be the result of my quote-unquote prayer? More lack, more misery. And we don't even realize we're doing it because we've convinced ourselves it's all got to do with trying to patronize despotic God up there who's watching us morning, noon and night to see if we put a foot wrong. I don't know how we ever got ourselves into this state as a race, but we're certainly in deep trouble.
Sure.
And it's so deeply embedded, it's almost, you know, it's a major, major task to try to get out of this. And people don't want to be told this either, you know, because I remember Nelson Mandela at his inauguration, a man whom I have a great admiration for. I met him and was very honored to do so. But at his inauguration, quoting Marianne Williamson, actually, I discovered later, he said, you know, the thing that frightens us most is not our weakness. Thing that frightens us most is our power. And that is really true. And you know why it's true? Because if we realized what we were trying to convey in What the Bleep and what I was trying to convey in my own DVDs, if we realized we had this power and that we are actually, whether we realize it or not, we are actually creating in the quantum field every day and have always been, we are frightened with the living daylights out of ourselves.
Huh.
And, you know, what we want instead is to be able to transfer the parents, if we're fortunate enough to have good parents, we want to transfer the parents who took care of us when we were children to a great parent in the sky, let's call it that, who will take care of us when we're adults. So we want to be told that everything is going to be fine. You know, you don't have to make any effort. You just spend your time making money or whatever it is. And you pay, you know, your dues to Jesus or to God, and all will be well. All you've got to do is place your trust in Christ Jesus or the Buddha or Muhammad or whoever has the franchise, and it'll be taken care of. And by the time you find out that that is not how it works at all, it's usually too late. And as I put it very unsympathetically, you're back to the diapers. And, you know, you've gained very little from that life experience. You've got to start all over again. I always say there are two things I don't waste time discussing. One is the existence of orbs. You buy a camera for $50, you can take all the pictures I took. Even if I do have the largest collection of orb pictures in the world, as many people have kindly said. I am not a missionary for orbs. You know, I'm not an evangelist out there to convince anyone. I've laid out the information I discovered after many, 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 many hundreds and thousands of hours for anyone who's interested in it. But I am not out there to persuade you. I don't care, one way or the other. So that's the first topic I don't discuss, the existence of orbs, because they're not dust, they're not pollen particles, they're not all these things, as anyone can find out very easily. The second thing I don't waste time discussing is the fact that we have lived before and we'll live again. Don't necessarily want to use the word reincarnation because it's loaded. If someone says to me, I don't believe in reincarnation, I say to them, well, you know what? That's probably exactly what you said the last time, too. And leave it at that. So, anyway, this is what I came to realize in my study of orbs, in my study of Jesus, my study of the theology of God, etc., that we really have been sold a dummy about why we're here.
Right.
And what we should be doing while we're here. more to the point. And in the article that I wrote for the Bleeping Herald last week, I postulated that the existence of aliens became impossible to deny. Now, let's just say that, whether you believe in them or don't, let's just say that this stage happens. Then, what are you going to make of all this system we've been fed?
Yeah,
as I started off by saying, we're told in the scriptures that God made man in his own image and likeness. Now I said, actually the title of the article, in whose image are those proverbial little green men then made? Because obviously we know that God is a Caucasian European being, you know, a human being in large and all that, and countless other doctrines. And what do we say? I mean, did these beings fall like Adam and Eve fell? And do they need a redeemer? And if so, there's only one redeemer, Jesus, who became a universal savior for the church. There's only, the only access to God is through Jesus. Now, did God the Father send Jesus to these other people in some other appropriate local form, just as he sent him here as a human? Or did they not need redemption? Did they never fall? If so, they're superior to us. And my God, we've always prided ourselves on being the race, the sole focus of God's purpose and design since creation began. So where does all this leave us?
Isn't that sort of what the Vatican kind of said? They were our space brothers and they weren't bound by the same rules with...
Yes, I know it's fine for the Vatican astronomer to say that, but the Vatican astronomer may not be a theologian.
Ah.
Now, what the Vatican astronomer would need, if that's what he meant, what he would need to look at really hard is, you have now departed from the central teaching of your own church.
Right.
Because that is not what the church says. The church says we are all fallen, and that the only access to God is through Jesus. Now, if you're saying there are space brothers who had no contact with Jesus, you have sold out on your version of Jesus, not in a minor, but in a catastrophically major way. So I leave them to sort that out for themselves. I just listed some of the consequences that have to be faced. But that's neither here nor there. Because the point is, and this is why I produced that second DVD, How Jesus Became a Christ, because he came here with the purpose of doing this. I mean, this wasn't an accident that happened. He came here to do this, to learn how to evolve the divine that's in every man and woman. And in other words, to use the image of the iceberg or of the electromagnetic spectrum to awaken those other parts of you and I that are living in the ultraviolet, in the gamma, the X-ray frequencies, so that we can do all the wonders that he spoke about. That's how the wonders are done.
Right.
In other words, if I'm a master, if I'm an ascended master, to use that hallowed phrase, it means I have now woken up all of those dimensions in myself. In other words, the point zero, or God, whatever word you wish to call it, the power of point zero is now living here on the bottom plane directly through me. The Kundalini force has been opened, which is a hotline. You know, ascension is not about going up anywhere. It's not about me on the bottom, the seventh plane, going back up to the first. Ascension is about me opening up a superconductor through these other six planes to the source. So that now, right here on this humble earth, as a man or woman, I am walking with the power of God in me. I am a God, man, or God, woman realized. That's what Jesus became.
That would almost be considered sacrilegious, that form of programming.
Not almost.
Yeah.
In other words, no, they want Jesus to suffer. I mean, it's quite a psychotic mindset, I often think, when the people who claim to love Jesus, they're not satisfied until they make him suffer the most, you know, when he was here. And if you say, you know, that this or that was, you know, it's not that Jesus did suffer, but that's not the point. What I'm saying is, if you get really hung up on that, and if you attempt to them to appear to say that, you know, that other things might be more important still, they get really annoyed. No, they want Jesus to suffer, and they want effigies of Jesus suffering hung everywhere. I said in the DVD, you know, really, you know, when we talk about the crucifix images, this horrible instrument of torture. I mean, it's almost impossible to think of a more painful death than this. I mean, we should be really having images of an electric chair or a gallows made and hang them on chains around our necks. It's the same thing. But, you know, it's not why Jesus came here. That's what he learned in Egypt, India, and Tibet. That was what was enshrined in the Christian system of sacraments. In other words, to bring out the divine, which is the six other levels of us.
Sure.
You know, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum from where we are at the bottom in the physical up to point zero at the other end of it and the range in between, we have customarily labeled those high energy states as spiritual, quote unquote, and we've labeled the low energy states, quote unquote, as physical. But actually, you know, we always thought of those as two hermetically sealed compartments.
Right.
They were totally separate from each other. And in fact, they're not. There's all one continuum. The spiritual and the physical are all a continuum. Is that a gain? It is. Most people would say, oh, that's a loss. We can't do that. It's not a loss. That's where our power and our evolution is going to come from.
Is the church aware of all this, but have changed everything to keep the masses?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, the church wants to keep us in subjection, and, you know, that's a big question in its own right. But I think there are wonderful things in religion, as I know it firsthand. I mean, there are wonderful people in religion that put us all to shame. I had the great privilege of knowing Mother Teresa of Calcutta personally.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, they're wonderful people, and, you know, she's obviously not the only one, far from it. I don't think that there's anyone out there, you know, plotting and planning to keep us in subjection. But that is not to say that the system isn't off.
Right.
And it's like I mentioned in that article on the aliens, this recent article, that the mental gymnastics that the religion has to go through to keep itself current. Now it's only aliens, now something else another time. Just like, you know, at the time of Galileo and Giordano Bruno 400 years ago, you know, did the earth was the earth the center of the solar system, and the sun and all the planets revolve around it, the Ptolemaic system?
Sure.
Or is it the other way, that Copernicus revealed around that time, or just slightly before it? And of course there was endless trouble about that, and the church decided no, the earth was at the center of the solar system. And of course Galileo was under house arrest for all his life, even though he said, you know, officially at least, he accepted the Ptolemaic system. Bruno was burned at the stake alive in 1600 for suggesting that there might be other planets where intelligent beings existed and who dealt with God in their own way. He was burned alive for that belief. Now, as I said in the end of this article, if the existence of aliens ever becomes incontrovertible, the church is going to bitterly mourn the loss of that 400-year head start which the invitation of Giordano Bruno would have given them.
Sure.
Because now they're going to have to try to catch up. And I'm afraid, because they've maneuvered themselves into such a corner in all this thing about guilt and suffering and Jesus dying, it's going to be almost impossible to come out of that corner without jettisoning most of their major beliefs. The matter is made more difficult for them because the major Christian denominations have always maintained that their central doctrines are perennially true and irreformable and therefore cannot change. So I leave it to them. They would have been much better off to have addressed this issue 400 years ago. When there are too many qualifications and adjustments and all that needed constantly to be made to keep a system intact, maybe what we should be acknowledging is that the original insights got it wrong. And I'm afraid that's the sort of state that a lot of religious belief is in right now.
Right.
That so many qualifications, you know, God loves you, and yet a child dies in terrible pain from cancer. Or God is this, and we say, oh no, you know, you don't understand it properly. There's this qualification, there's that qualification. And in the end, you know, we have to say, they've been all saying in German, weg mit dem Tool, you know, away with the whole lot, because it's all unnecessary. And maybe we should realize that Jesus didn't come here for that purpose. He came for a much more sublime purpose.
Sure.
And the sooner we got on the right track, the better the churches would be doing their job, and the better off you and I will be, and the better the answers we will have to those four great questions.
Right.
Who am I? Where did I come from? What should I do? And what may I expect?
Right.
In other dimensions about here. So if we do succeed in awakening those six dimensions above us that were part of my being, then we will do all the wonders that Jesus did in greater. He came here to teach us how to do that. But instead, his disciples said, how do we make sense of this great person? And they thought of their festival of Yom Kippur in the days of the temple 2,000 years ago. Every year they remembered the fall of our first parents, which the book of Genesis tells us about, Adam and Eve. And they recall in that festival how we have sinned as our first parents sinned, and we apologize to God and ask his forgiveness. And there were two animals associated with that festival in the days of the temple, the goat and the lamb, the spotless lamb. The goat in the ceremonies in the temple was laden up with symbolic baggage and driven out into the desert of Judea to be torn apart, carrying away the burdens of our guilt symbolically. And while in the temple, the lamb was sacrificed on the altar, and the spilling of its blood was supposed to appease God's vengeance against you and I. So instead of spilling our blood, the lamb spilt it for us. So his first disciples said, heavens, this is it. Jesus is the quintessential goat and lamb of Yom Kippur. He is the one who will take our burdens on his back like the goat, who will die for our sins like the lamb. And so the whole thing became focused in on sin, punishment, reparation to God, sacrifice, guilt, fear. There you have it. So that is what happened to the message of Jesus Christ.
Sounds very anti-productive.
Very. But if you realize that instead he came to teach us how to access the dimensions of us that are hidden, which is what we're here to do,
right,
then obviously the message of Jesus Christ is perpetually relevant and central to why we're here today.
You've mentioned about the article, I guess you wrote just last week, and talking about aliens and whatnot.
Yeah.
There seems to be a number of paintings and sketches that seem to show crafts in the air and a number of frescoes. What is, in your research, have you been able to examine kind of a chronological series of these crafts, and what is your thoughts on it? How long, if they do exist?
Well, there are depictions, you know, in,
sure,
in ancient writings, not just in paintings, but in sculptures, etc., going way back, about something in the sky, you know, that looks like an orb or a disc.
Sure.
And obviously, you know, until recent times, when we became familiar with what these appearances might be, we didn't know really what to make of them. But there are paintings where you see these formations, shall we call them, not to prejudice the issue one way or another. These formations that are spherical or like an ellipse in the sky, and that are relating to certain momentous occasions happening,
yes,
on the ground. Say like the Annunciation of the Angel Gabriel to,
correct,
Mary in a famous painting of this, mm-hmm, kind. You have this disc up there and a beam of light coming down from it. And you have, you know, way much further back in history, the famous interventions with Ezekiel, when the fiery chariot came down. You know, they have to describe these things in accordance with what they were able to understand at the time.
Sure.
And maybe all, you know, a person, say, 3,000 years ago, all they can say when they see something like a spacecraft is it's a fiery chariot, because they know what a chariot is, and then they add fire to it, and that's close they could come. So undoubtedly there are witnesses throughout history in depictions of this kind, about these mysterious phenomena.
Right.
And nobody was quite sure what they were. Now, you know, we have a different perspective now, and we could suggest what kind that they were. And I'm working on a book called The Other Side of Jesus, but I'm also working on a fourth DVD. My third one was orbs, as I mentioned to you, because orbs, you might say, your first was on God, your second was on Jesus, and now about orbs. This is an odd succession. It isn't, actually, because what the orbs tell us is that we're living in a frequency-based universe, and that there are frequencies attached to you and me, of which we have either let them go asleep or become unconscious of them. We need to waken up those frequency aspects of ourselves. So that is where the Orb DVD fits in. We're in a frequency-based universe, and we have, John, we have hypnotized ourselves into a trance of what I call scarcity, a trance of scarcity. You know, we're living in a world where things are scarce, and I've got to get my share, or what I believe is my share, before some other guy gets it. And if I don't, you know, I'll be left short. So it's all about competition and, you know, domination of others and battling. This is the kind of world we're in. We're in a trance that things are scarce. Now, if we look at the kind of universe the orbs tell us about, which is why I call it the DVD, Clues to a More Exciting Universe, well, then you see that there are dimensions here, and that the creation of whatever abundance or scarcity we happen to experience down here comes from what we're programming in the quantum field. So are we living in a universe of scarcity? On the contrary, we're living in whatever kind of universe we decide. And most of us find it a lot easier to believe in scarcity than in abundance because, you know, the conditioning and the histories we sure. have it. So I often use the image, say, of the Colorado River running down through the state of California. And, you know, every township and farm on the way taps into its waters. And by the time it gets to the Mexican border, there's nothing or almost nothing left. And that's the kind of universe we think we're in. Limited supply. And the more people tap in, the less there's left. This is not so. A much better analogy of the kind of universe you and I are living in would be like a radio station or a TV station. I mean, if I broadcast a TV, any of the great networks, CNN, ABC, etc., Fox, whatever, they send out a signal. Now, supposing one television set is turned on the entire world, that's a great signal, of course, say, from the TV station. If a million people tune in, still a great signal. 10 million, 100 million, 1,000 million, the signal is unaffected, right?
Right.
In other words, that is much more close to the kind of universe we're in by terms of analogy than the Colorado River. In other words, we are living in a universe of abundance. It doesn't matter how many people tune into that radio station.
It's unaffected.
The signal is never going to run dry. And that is actually the kind of universe we're living in, and that's why I think I ended up the Orb DVD on that note. So, you know, we're living in a much we're living in a much, much, much more hopeful situation than we realize. And unfortunately, the agencies that have been or have decided to take charge of our destiny are actually doing harm. And this is where I come back to Mother Teresa and the wonderful people and the wonderful things. I mean, Christianity has done wonderful things for people over the centuries. Absolutely. You would be a fool or an ignorant person not to recognize that. That's not the point. The point is this. Let me give an example. If I believe fervently that the moon is made of green cheese, yeah, that's fine as a belief. Except if I happen to be an astronaut, then it's a disastrous belief. But if I'm not an astronaut, it's fine to believe it. You know, it's not going to affect anything. But if I'm an astronaut, you really should disabuse yourself of the belief that the moon is made of green cheese or any of the other heavenly bodies. Likewise, if I am told by the agencies that are supposed to be in charge of my eternal destiny and evolution that what I'm here for is to be tested, that God is watching me and is noting down everything in what used to be called the Book of Life in my DVD, the first DVD, The Hamburg Universe, I gave God a laptop on the cover because God has moved at the times like everyone else. And then when we die, you know, God presses enter, and depending on the total, I'm sent up to heaven to sit in a cloud staring at God, which is supposed to be a reward, or sent down to hell. If I'm told by the agencies that are in charge of my destiny that that's what I am here for, I'm here to be tested, I'm here to make reparation to God for all the sins that I've personally committed, as well as the whole race back to Adam and Eve, and that at the end of my life I'm going to either go up or go down, depending on how I've responded to a given set of rules, which might be 10 in Christianity, 538 in Judaism, or 722 in Islam. If that is what I'm being told, obviously I'm never going to awaken those six other levels within me. In other words, I'm never going to achieve the actual purpose for which I was put here on this earth by God. So, like believing the moon is made of green cheese, you know, if you're not in charge of someone's eternal destiny, or if they believe you're in charge of it, and you put out this stuff, then you'd be like teaching astronauts that the moon is made of green cheese. In other words, it doesn't matter how many wonderful people you have had, and how many wonderful things were accomplished throughout history in terms of human liberation, because you're actually teaching a false set of information about how reality functions, which will effectively prohibit people from attaining their destiny. You just have to repeat it. That is the problem.
Right.
So it could be changed.
And great segue, because I was just going to ask, so how could somebody work towards changing that?
Well, in programming the subconscious or superconscious, which was what we started off talking about, there are a number of significant hurdles to be overcome. First of all, the superconscious has already been programmed by you and I. There are certain things that are in there that are regarded as essential for the superconsciousness to take care of, to ensure that you and I are safe, happy, healthy, etc. It's extremely difficult to alter one of those.
Really?
Extremely difficult. Now, if I decide, you know, that I've understood all this stuff, etc., and that I am really here to do something much more wonderful with my life than just obey the rules and safely retire and not have too much pain at the end, and I'm going to make a change in my life, and I'm going to try and get these ideas, I'm talking about law of attraction, all this stuff, I'm going to try to get these ideas into my superconscious, so as to live by this new set of rules rather than the old set. It's been in there, you know, 20, 40, 60, 80 years. Now, the first thing you have to realize is what I mentioned at the start, that the superconsciousness, which has this incredible processing capacity of 400 million bits of information per second, does not know the difference between an external input, which we call reality, and an internal input from my consciousness. In other words, if I believe that I am radiantly healthy, that makes the same impact on the superconsciousness as if I am actually radiantly healthy. If I believe I am fabulously wealthy, it's the same impact on the superconsciousness as if I actually were a billionaire in physical reality. So there is no judgment about whatever comes through the mind, through the frontal lobe, through the quantum field, and what comes from external reality. But if we are putting in some new idea into this, or trying to, and it conflicts with something that's already been put in there previously 30 years before, all hell will break loose with the superconscious. Because it's going to say, hey, that's not what you put in here 30 years ago. There is a judgment in that sense in the superconscious. What way does that manifest? It manifests in extreme sensations of insecurity, fear, turbulence, I don't know what's right anymore. Terrible, I call it dissonance. Huge dissonance is set up. Now, if you persevere through that, if you know what's going on, it will stop. And the new idea will take the place of the old. But all hell will break loose, and there is no way to avoid that. So you've got to know that this is coming, and to know where it's coming from and why, and that it's just a matter of reprogramming. That's why I said earlier that all our programs for self-improvement, ranging from New Year resolutions down to the law of attraction, don't work, because people think they're trying to program the quantum field through the conscious mind. The conscious mind has no access to the quantum field. It is the superconscious mind that has access to the quantum field. So if you want the quantum field to change, you're going to have to do a little more and say, oh, the law of attraction, just lie back and have your martini and attract stuff to you. You're not going to get squat because you're trying to do it consciously. These are all conscious programs, and they're missing the point. So if the agencies that were in charge of our destiny or claimed to be would realize that and would realize that the message of Jesus was all about that, what a different world we would be in. I mean, if we realized 1,000 years ago that Jesus didn't come here to suffer and die for our sins to appease the vengeance of a savage God against us, but came here for an entirely different and much more sublime reason, which was to unveil the eternal and the divine within every man and woman, what atrocities we would have been spared
right
over the last millennium, not to speak of anything else.
Sure.
So, is it possible for the religions to change? Yes, it is. Will they change? I wouldn't put my money on it. Will they have to change if an incontrovertible fact should have floated into the screen?
Yes.
Well, they either change or perish. Will they all disappear? No. Because most of the fascination and attraction for this kind of religious belief, it doesn't have to be that kind, but this kind of religious belief comes from people wanting to be taken care of. There will always be people who will want to be taken care of, and there will always be agencies who will fill that niche for them. Will they actually be taken care of? No. But as I said earlier, no one will find that out until it's too late, and they'll find that they weren't taken care of.
If somebody wanted to be able to purchase some of your DVDs, where and whereabouts would they go to do it?
Well, you can do it, say, off Amazon, mm-hmm. or you could do it off my own website, which is probably easier. www.hamburgeruniverse.com. H-A-M-B-U-R-G-E-R, the bun and the meat, hamburger and universe, U-N-I-V-E-R-S-E.com. My three DVDs are there. The fourth one is coming, which is called How Did We Get Here? And What Legacy Did It Leave Behind? You know, to think that we came into existence because of a personal and direct intervention of God during a particularly busy week 6,000 years ago, which is what some minor groups say, is, of course, bizarre. There's much more to the creation than that. It doesn't diminish God, it exalts God, and it exalts us. But it's time we moved away. But there are legacies to how we came into existence, and many of the interventions that you have talked about previously in history through alien intervention is a major part of that. And that has left a legacy in us. I call them the four great diseases of the mind. That is a legacy of how we came into existence as a race. And I'll just mention one of them, the need for approval. Or disapproval. Same thing. You know, this is grilled into us from our earliest years. You know, you need the approval of your parents to be allowed to do something. You need the approval of your teachers in school, university, the approval of professor. And, you know, when you're in a job, you need the approval of your peers or the boss. And if you're an unfortunate politician, you need the approval of everyone to get re-elected. But giving your power away is what happens when you're needing approval. Now, if you're like, you know, it's like so many radical people say, I don't give a hoot whether you approve me or not. You're trying to attract disapproval then. You can't live without disapproval. But, you know, needing approval or needing disapproval is equally damaging. Until you can take a firm stand on your own worth. Now, that doesn't mean you have to kick out the cat. It just means, you know, I am a valuable person. I have the divine life within me. The kingdom of heaven, as Jesus put it, is within me. And, you know, I may have to take orders from somebody, but I'm not giving my power away to them. I don't live with my tongue hanging out for their approval or their disapproval. I am taking a stand on my own worth. And that is sufficient. That tendency, that trait, is deeply buried in your and my DNA and countless generations back to where we first began. However, I think we've said enough for one day.
And it's been just a pleasure, sir. I had no idea what to expect when James told me to stick around. But if I could say this, coming from a Judeo-Christian background, you have exploded my mind into a whole different realm of perception.
Well, it's certainly good for the Judeo-Christian tradition, because this is what the Judeo-Christian tradition was supposed to be about. So I think the sooner we get the assessors in and get back on track, the better it'll be for everybody, for the Judeo-Christian tradition, and for you and me, right, everyone else in this world. And orbs, I mean, those are, for the first time with orbs, we have a situation where you no longer need to be a guru, or an avatar, or a mystic, or some specially favored by God person.
Right.
All you need is a cheap digital camera.
Right.
A child can do this.
Right.
For the first time, we've access to those dimensions. Now, you know, is that a wonderful thing? It is a wonderful thing. And, you know, if anyone wants to send me their pictures, I do get a lot of pictures on my website. Say, what is this? Or am I getting on the right track here? You know, can send them to me on my website, Hamburger Universe, and I will try to offer any help I can with the photography, etc. I would recommend one thing on this program.
Okay.
In the book, The Orb Project, which I published last November, I did point out something really important in the photography of orbs, which is get the right camera. Now, film cameras are capable of photographing orbs, but you'll get far, far, far fewer. A digital camera is immensely superior. Why? Because a digital camera is sensitive to a small band of what we call high infrared. And orbs are better seen there than invisible light. A digital camera that's not corrected for infrared light coming in is inclined to make people's faces look, you know, very washed
white,
out, white, mm-hmm. white, as you know very well.
Mm-hmm.
So most film manufacturers put in infrared filters to diminish the infrared light coming in. Now, of course, if orbs are seen mostly in that band, if you have too many infrared filters, even though it's an excellent camera, it won't take squat in terms of orbs. I've made major, major mistakes. I paid $1,200 a few years ago for a Nikon, a superb camera, but it was so heavily filtered it never took one orb picture from that day to this. It's a beautiful camera which I use for other photography. So I invented a little test. If you want to buy a camera and you want to take orb pictures, here's what I would suggest before you spend a lot of money and make the same mistake I did. Bring your TV remote control or your stereo remote control, anything that sends out an infrared light
signal.
Beam,
mm-hmm.
and bring it to your local camera shop. And here's when you become undying friends with the local camera salespeople, because you'd have to ask them to put batteries in the cameras, and most of them don't. So they go to the back room and rustle for a battery and come out. So load up your camera, turn it on, and take your TV remote control, put it right up against the front housing of the lens, and press any of the buttons. That should send out an infrared beam
mm-hmm.
directly into the digital camera. On the back of the camera, on the little screen, you should see a generous bloom of bluish-white light or some other shade near to it. If you don't, or you see only a tiny little spark or a small amount, move on to the next camera, because that camera won't be much good for orbs.
Right.
If you use that simple little test, you will save yourself a lot of mistakes that I did. And as I say, if anyone wants to send me their pictures at my website, I'd be glad to try and help them. There are lots of mistakes you can make in orb photography, and some very impressive formations look like spacecraft landing or preternatural occurrences, and they're not. But you know, it's easy to avoid them, and I'll be happy to try and help people if they take the trouble of emailing me a couple of pictures on my website, Hamburger Universe.
And they can contact you at www.hamburgeruniverse.com.
And be patient. I am a one-man operation, and I'm doing a lot of traveling and speaking all over the world. I've just come from Glastonbury, as I told you. So if you don't get answered immediately, the world is not about to end. It's just that I haven't managed to reach on it at that precise time, but you will be answered.
Well, we appreciate you joining us for our show here at the ATS Mix, and we wish you further continued success in your research and your venture, sir.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a great pleasure to be on with you.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.